Hi, I'm David Kleon. I'm senior editor at Blogging Heads TV, and this is an episode of Worldwise, and I'm speaking with Isaac Stonefish, who has hosted Blogging Heads before. Isaac, why don't you introduce yourself?
David, thanks for having me. I'm Asia editor at Foreign Policy Magazine here in DC. And before that, I lived in Beijing for about 6 years, most recently with Newsweek as a correspondent for them. And I've been watching closely Obama's trip to Asia this week.
Yes, so that's one of the things we're going to talk about today. President Obama, at the time we're recording this, has I guess completed the first day of his trip to four U.S. allies in East Asia. He's been in Japan. He went to the restaurant from Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which I have not seen, but I hear is great. Apparently, the sushi was great, and met with their leader Shinzo Abe. He's also going to South Africa, Malaysia, and the Philippines. So let's talk about his visit to Japan first. What are the major issues right now in U.S.-Japanese strategic relations, and what's the backdrop for this trip?
So the major issue with Obama's trip to all four of these countries is the country that he's not visiting, namely China. With Japan, the major issue with China is tensions over uninhabited islands in the East China Sea, which the Japanese call the Senkakus and the Chinese call the Diaoyu. Obama, in an interview with a Japanese newspaper, said that the islands do fall in under Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty, which is something that Obama has not said before. Secretary Clinton said that before. So that's something the Japanese have wanted to hear from Obama and something that he has delivered. With South Korea, China is less of an issue. North Korea is the biggest threat for them. So in South Korea, expect Obama to talk a lot about trade, to talk about defending from South Korea, and also to make some sort of statement of support for South Korea as they deal with this horrific ferry disaster that
Yes.
happened just a couple of days ago and where hundreds of people are believed to be dead. Philippines, especially China, comes up again with tensions, with disputes over the Scarborough Shoal, another small uninhabited piece of rock in the Pacific Ocean that, unlike the Senkakus, the Scarborough Shoal is actually now basically de facto owned by the Chinese. They have ships there. It is what they say is their territory, and they actually administer it more than the Philippines do. So Obama is expected to announce a new military arrangement between the Philippines and the United States, which should go some way to assuage some of those concerns. And in Malaysia, again, China is going to be a specter on the trip, but not as much as in the Philippines or as in Japan.
Right. And I guess, I have more specific questions about those countries in a sec, but on this Diaoyu Senkaku dispute, the main issue in Japan, why does either country want these uninhabited islands, and what are their claims?
It's a good question. So there's the historic issue. There's the which kind of goes in with sentimentality as well. There's the strategic issue, and then there's also energy. Energy is the easiest one. The waters around the islands might hold large reserves of natural resources. Strategic, the islands would help if China were to own the islands. They would help position it in the East China Sea. It would help it be easier to not launch an attack on Taiwan, which people don't think is in the cards anytime soon, but would allow it to further, basically move out further into the ocean, have better positioning to further intercept Japanese ships, to be closer to Taiwan. But I think the bigger issue is a feeling among the Chinese that in disputes with Japan, they've gotten the raw end of the bargain for the last 100 years. The Senkakus themselves were overseen by the United States since after World War II, and in 1972, the United States gave them back to Japan. In meetings between Chinese and Japanese in the 70s and 80s, both sides agreed to shelve the dispute to a later time, and I think the later time is now. You have a lot of Chinese really feeling not like there's anything on the Senkakus most likely that the Chinese really want. It's more just a very symbolic sign that China has been wronged in the past, and if they get the islands back, it's a small step towards China being resuming its place as a power in Asia.
Are there significant political significant political developments in either or both countries that have sort of brought this issue to the fore now? I mean, why now is this being revisited? What's going on in Beijing and in Tokyo that's making this suddenly an issue?
I think you could say, so the issue first rose again in, I think it was 2010, when a Chinese fishing boat captain, who was later found out to be drunk, rammed into a Japanese vessel. The Japanese held on to the captain, sparked huge anti-Japanese protests in China. And I think that reminded people, because the crashes happened around the Diaoyu, it reminded people that, oh, this used to be a very big issue. And I think from there it grew. I think in terms of political trends happening in Beijing, in Tokyo, in China, you have a new leader consolidating power, and it's really difficult to say how much of the increase in military tensions happens because they are Xi Jinping's plans or they are the plans of the military. In other words, we really don't know how much daylight there is between what Xi Jinping wants and what the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army, wants. But I think for this, we assume that this is Xi making a point that China is far more important, far more assertive than it was before, and these islands are a way of demonstrating that. At the same time, Chinese economy is slowing down, and I think the Chinese leaders are well aware of this visceral anti-Japanese sentiment that runs among their populace. And I think they know that if they needed a excuse, if they found that their legitimacy was in question, striking hard against the Japanese, being seen as very tough against the Japanese would be a very, very popular move. So tensions with the Senkakus would be a way to demonstrate that. I think in Japan, you have Shinzo Abe, who came into office December 2012, about a year and a half ago, and is the first strong leader Japan has had since Koizumi about 8 or 9 years ago. Had a lot of really short-term prime ministers before then, and I think he's also trying to make his mark on Asia. He's also trying to say, hey, Japan is back. He had that very very highly regarded economic program dubbed Abenomics. And even though it only saw growth of, I guess, about 0.7% last year, it's earned a lot of plaudits that Japan might be moving out of its lost decades. And just the same as for China, another way to show that Japan is a player is by staying tough to China.
Now, since Obama is visiting the country, beyond this island dispute, how have U.S.-Japanese relations been in recent years, and especially under Obama? Traditionally they've been one of our closest allies. Is that holding up?
I think it is. I think there's a lot of there's a lot of trust between the two sides. I mean, I think people in the administration are a little worried about Abe's nationalist tendencies. You have to remember he visited the Yasukuni Shrine in central Tokyo in December, and that angered not only South Korea and China because of Japan's aggression towards China and South Korea, or invasion towards them during World War II, but it was also very offensive to a lot of people in the United States because among the 14 Class A war criminals whose souls are interred in Yasukuni Shrine is also someone who was responsible for the attack on Pearl Harbor. Wow. So by Abe honoring Yasukuni, he's not only honoring war criminals who were very offensive to his neighbors, but also offensive to the United States. So I think there's a little hesitation about if Abe can keep his nationalism in check enough to be a really good partner. But I think overall relations between the two countries are strong and that their interests are aligned, that they both want to manage the rise of China. They both want to see the U.S. and Japan working well together. They want to see Japan as a more assertive ally in other parts of the world. Japan might sign on to sanctions against Russia. Japan has been helpful with the U.S. in Syria, and I think people in the administration appreciate that.
There have been some tensions in recent years, or I guess ongoing tensions for many years, over to the U.S. base in Okinawa as well, right? Has there been any news on that front, or is that something they're going to discuss?
That will probably come up in discussions, and it's still an issue, though I think the U.S. side appreciates that Abe has been more willing to go against local sentiment. I think other leaders, there's a Japanese prime minister a couple of years ago who resigned because he was unable to work out a negotiation on the bases in Okinawa. And I think while there's the base relocation is still probably many years away, Abe has made a lot more progress on that than his recent predecessors.
Okay. Well, let's turn to some of the other countries. And I apologize to audiences in advance if anything crazy happens between when we record this and when it posts, which I doubt. But so first of all, South Korea. Well, you mentioned this ferry incident. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what the U.S. is doing about that?
I think with other natural disasters, or this one might be man-made because it seems like there was impropriety or alleged impropriety among the crew who didn't allow some of the hundreds of passengers on the ferry to leave. But I think what the U.S. tries to do in times like this is just to show that it is very supportive and that can be helpful either with kind of more hard things or just more soft things by showing support and concern. But I think
this was just a domestic tourist incident, just a local ferry sank. And do we have an idea of how many people died?
I think the latest numbers were 150 or so confirmed dead, Jesus. And then I think another 100 missing. So, it was nothing to do with North Korea. It wasn't terrorism. It just seems like it was a combination of human error and the environment. But it is one of the worst disasters to hit South Korea in decades. And, South Korea, for a very long time, it was a very poor country ruled by a dictatorship and transitioned in the mid-80s. And events like that were far more common when South Korea was far more shambolic. But now that it's a developed country, one of the most wired, if not the world's most wired country, I think there's a lot of anger in South Korea that something like this could have happened.
Wow. So what about tensions with North Korea? What's new on that front? And what is the U.S. and concerned about there?
I mean, I think in many ways, absolutely nothing is new in tensions. I mean, North Korea seems to be playing the same game that it's been playing for a very long time. I should add here that North Korea is the world's most opaque country, and we really have no idea how decisions are being made in Pyongyang. That said, there's reports that they could be planning another nuclear test and that Kim Jong-un and his father, who was the leader before him, Kim Jong-il, did like to raise tensions or act very provocatively when a major foreign leader was visiting Seoul or when a South Korean leader was in an important meeting elsewhere. So we could expect, it's possible that North Korea will do something when Obama is meeting with the South Korean president. They could do absolutely nothing at all. But I think the biggest threat that North Korea has always posed is uncertainty. It's very difficult to know if they have plans to attack South Korea, if they have plans to do something else like sink the Chonan, a South Korean sub that they sunk, I think 2010 it was, and killed, I think, 43 South Korean sailors, or if they actually want better relations with South Korea, better relations with America, and want to ratchet down the tensions. We just really don't know.
Well, what are the feelings from the South Korean side? Is the current government in South Korea more interested in reconciliation and brinksmanship? What's their general approach to North Korea?
I wouldn't say brinksmanship. I also wouldn't say they're pursuing as open of a policy as a South Korean leader did on the turn of the century when he actually went to Pyongyang and met with Kim Jong-il. I think they're pursuing what could be characterized as more of a middle of the road approach. I think the end game for both for South Korea is reunification with North Korea. Park has come out and said that she wants reunification. I don't think anyone expects that to happen anytime soon, but I think the South has already won the game of history. The South is far more successful. That changed in the late 70s, early 80s. So since then, I think the kind of the general approach of a lot of South Korean leaders, Park included, has been to play what could be termed a waiting game, to say, hey, we're going to try to prevent any disasters. We're going to try to, as much as we can, prevent the North Koreans from feeling so hemmed in that they'll shell islands, that they'll try to sink a sub. We'll try to be open for dialogue and at the same time appear strong enough so that we don't alienate constituencies at home that want a stronger hand against North Korea.
Makes sense. So with the with Malaysia and the Philippines, I guess both of those countries are currently reeling from different kinds of catastrophes. In the case of the Philippines, the huge tsunami that hit a few months ago, and in Malaysia, obviously, this lost plane. Is Obama, I guess, concerned with addressing those in the ferry incident we just discussed, or is this mainly about China?
I think with the Philippines, it will be more about China than it will be with Malaysia. I think Malaysia is a country that gets mostly ignored by the Western world unless something like this happens.
Right, and unless they become CNN's only subject for a month or so, which seems to have happened recently.
It's amazing. But I was looking at the stories the New York Times had done about Malaysia, and I think there was maybe three from October until March. Then suddenly, boom, story every day, story several times a day, because MH370 is such a compelling story.
Although it's finally kind of, people have finally stopped trying to make news out of it, right?
It's still on CNN a lot. It's on in our newsroom, and it still does flicker across the screen every once in a while. I think Obama has to bring it up either privately or publicly, and he'll probably express condolences, express a measure of support. It's just, when Americans think of Malaysia right now, they think of MH370. So that is unavoidable. That will, in some sense, overshadow other parts of the trip. This is the first trip by a sitting U.S. president to Malaysia since LBJ in the 60s. So I think the Malaysian government wanted this to be about their successes, wanted this to be about them presenting to the world that they are a moderate, reasonably successful, middle-class, middle-economy Malaysian Muslim democracy. And I think MH370 and also the fact that there's some not so good human rights abuses happening in Malaysia. They have a very unfree press. The opposition leader, Anwar Ibrahim, has just been convicted again, almost certainly falsely, of charges of sodomy, which will put him back in prison for a very long time and will prevent him from being able to act to challenge the current prime minister in power. So I don't think this trip is going to be that much of a positive for the Malaysian government.
There are some angles regarding the Malaysian government as well as its relationship with China that did come up in the plane story, right? About possible incompetence on their end, and also most of the passengers were they ethnic Chinese or Chinese nationals or both? But they were headed to China at any rate, right?
Most of the passengers were Chinese nationals, and I think there's a lot of anger that because so many Chinese died in the plane crash, there was anger that Malaysia really bumbled the investigation. Not only did they act extremely untransparently, they made it seem like the plane had landed, I think it was in the South China Sea. So investigators lost 8 or 9 days looking there when right. They should have been looking probably deeper in the Western Pacific.
Wasn't it the Indian Ocean? I thought last I heard, because it wasn't like Australia.
Oh. Yeah. I think it's part of the Pacific. I think it's a very remote part of the Pacific, but I could be wrong on that. So we'll have to check.
Yeah. Well, in any case, what are Sino-Malaysian relations like normally, this plane incident aside? And how is that? Yeah,
I think the relations that China mostly ignores because it can. They do have territorial disputes, but the flashpoints are much more with Vietnam and the Philippines than they are with Malaysia. They have strong economic ties. I think, Malaysia tries, because it's a small country, tries to appeal both to the West, to Europe, and to China. But just like in the United States, when Americans completely ignored Malaysia until MH370, the same was true in China. Chinese people were not paying attention to what was happening in Malaysia until something like this happened. There is a large ethnic Chinese population in Malaysia. I think it's about 25% or so. And they tend to be, I think, wealthier, better educated than the native Malays. And sometimes that causes tensions. And I think, when those blow up, China gets concerned. But I think those have been pretty calm for a while.
So Obama, as you mentioned at the beginning, this is conspicuously not visiting China on this trip. How does Beijing see this trip, and how does Beijing see sort of the general pivot to Asia, if that's even a thing? What are they concerned about Obama shoring up their U.S. relations with their neighbors?
It's a good question. I think the loudest Chinese voices, which don't necessarily represent mainstream thinking in Beijing, consider the pivot a ill-disguised plan by the Obama administration and by Hillary Clinton, who is generally very disliked among people who work in the government in Beijing.
Given the high likelihood of her being our next president, that's something maybe people should know more. But
I think they see her as the architect of the pivot, and they feel like the pivot is a strategy to contain China. Mm-hmm. And they say, hey, okay, you have Obama visiting a country that neighbors China on the northeast, and then another country that neighbors it slightly more south on the northeast, and then a country that's directly east of it, and then you're visiting a country that's southeast of it. So what else would you be doing if other than containing China? You kind of imagine if I think they would compare it to Chinese president visiting Canada and Mexico and maybe even Hawaii or several. Not Hawaii is a bad example, but other islands in the Caribbean,
Dominican Republic, or somewhere.
Cuba, and not making a stop in China. You have carrier groups that hang out in that part of the world, and I think there's a lot of dueling op-eds about what the administration should do with the pivot, what they should be saying. But I think maybe the consensus is that they should be clear on what this means to China. We basically make up our mind over whether or not we are going to accept the rise of China or we're going to try to contain it.
I mean, why not throw in if I mean, it doesn't seem like that's such a radical view on their part. Why not throw in a visit to Beijing? I mean, it is one of the most important bilateral relationships in the world, the U.S. and China. It's not exactly, out of the way if you're going to Tokyo and Seoul. Why not drop by, say hi, discuss, just regular bilateral issues? I mean, it does seem like a trip like this is very pointed in its exclusion of China. Is that fair?
I'm sure the question of whether or not Obama should visit Beijing was heavily debated among administration officials and among Chinese. The actual reason why they decided not to visit Beijing on this trip, I have absolutely no idea. I'm sure there was a very good one. It is a very calculated, conspicuous absence. But for some reason, I think they weighed the pros and cons and figured the pros of saving the time and of possibly sending this message to China that, these are our allies in the region. We are here with them. Yes, we like you, but in order for us to give you this kind of face that would deserve a visit, here are the other things that you need to help us on. That could be a message that they're sending.
Yeah. One last thing about that, and then I want to turn to domestic Chinese issues in your article recently, but I've been closely monitoring the situation in Ukraine. I'm sure you have too. And there's been a lot of talk about, mostly among kind of hawkish commentators in the U.S., but about the Obama administration seeming and European countries as well seeming impotent vis-a-vis Putin. That Putin has basically shown that he can violate the sovereignty of a neighbor, Ukraine in this case. He can get condemned. He can get some light, you know, kicked out of the G8, some light sanctions slapped on his inner circle. But basically, he can get away with annexing Crimea and possibly other parts of Ukraine. It's an ongoing situation. You know, he's a nuclear armed power, and Russia's a permanent member of the UN Security Council and can veto any condemnation against it, which it has. And I sort of wonder, China is also a nuclear armed superpower and permanent member of the UN Security Council, and obviously has a number of territorial disputes in the region that we've discussed, in the East China Sea, the South China Sea, possibly with Taiwan someday. Do you see any geopolitical lessons that China could be learning from this situation in Eastern Europe, and possibly applying to what it sees as its own sphere of influence?
It's a good question. I think China appreciates that the more distracted the United States is in Europe or in the Middle East, the freer of a hand that it has with Japan. China wants to be careful not to unleash the self-determination desires of some of its own people. You know, you remember the Crimea referendum mm-hmm. allowed the Crimeans to vote, you know, vote in quotations, yes. But China doesn't want there to be precedent where people can vote to join Chinese territory with the possible exception of Taiwan, because if you can vote to join Chinese territory, you should be able to vote to leave Chinese territory. And I don't think it wants to plant that idea in the head of Tibetans or Uyghurs, right. Or even possibly the Koreans or the Mongolians who live in relatively large numbers in the borders with those two countries.
China does hold some kind of sham elections, though, right? I mean, at regional, you know, maybe like one party elect. I mean, is there an electoral process that's approved of in theoretically communist China?
China holds village elections, and at the national level, Xi Jinping is described as being elected party secretary and being chosen as party secretary. And we're not sure exactly what kind of horse trading goes on behind closed doors. But I think from party histories about different periods, the standing committee members of the Politburo and the Politburo members do actually conduct a vote at some point for the next party secretary. But we don't know how that vote happened for Xi Jinping, how many people were allowed to vote, whether the vote actually mattered, how much of it was determined beforehand. So if you define election very, very broadly, right. That is chosen by other people, then you could, with some verbal pyrotechnics, make the case that China does hold elections for its top positions. But it's a stretch.
Okay. Well, that's actually a good place to segue to an article that you wrote, I guess, in the past week for Foreign Policy, in which you discuss the how the Communist Party's monopoly on power might potentially end someday. Can you describe what you say in that piece, and we'll provide a link as well, and maybe elaborate on your thesis a little bit?
Dave, I'm sorry, the speaker just cut out there. Would you mind repeating the question?
Absolutely, and we can edit that part. Okay, so let's segue now to a piece that you wrote for Foreign Policy in the last week, in which you describe the eventual collapse of the Communist Party in China and ways that might happen. Collapse, or at least collapse of its monopoly on power. And you draw an interesting analogy, not to the Communist Party in the Soviet Union, which people might think is the obvious analogy, but to the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, in Mexico, which is actually the current governing party in Mexico, but lost its monopoly on power in the 90s. So can you sort of describe what you say in that piece, and we'll provide a link, and just kind of elaborate on that thesis?
Sure. So the Chinese Communist Party, which has been in power in China since 1949, often studies the experience of the Russian Communist Party. And in part, there are some things they can learn from that. The two parties do share a lot of similarities, both structurally and ideologically. But the experiences of the PRI in Mexico in the 80s and 90s, I argue, are more similar to what China is facing today. Russia, Soviet Union in the 1980s was a very chaotic, very poor place. They were extremely isolated. The people didn't have, there's long bread lines. There was just a lot of economic problems, whereas China today is richer than it's ever been. There's confidence about the economy, confidence about the future, which is similar to what you saw in the 80s and 90s. The repression that characterized Soviet history in the 70s and 80s, I would argue, is further away from where China is today than the in the 80s and 90s. China's authoritarian is softer than Russia's was and closer to the pre's. I'd say you could put it somewhere in between those two, but closer to the pre. And I think the leaders of Mexico in the 70s, 80s, and 90s were much more competent technocrats than the drunk old men who ruled Russia as the Soviet Union began to fall apart.
That does seem likely from my knowledge of both countries. So you see potentially some process by which China might evolve into a multi-party democracy in which the current ruling Communist Party still has a voice. I mean, it seems like there would be formidable hurdles to getting to that point in the next decade or so, let's say. But can you see any way that might happen?
Yeah, but I want to be careful here to not predict the future, which is impossible.
Of course.
I mean, it's basically, everything falls apart. The pre was the longest running one-party state in the 20th century. They lasted for 71 years. Soviet Union, the Communist Party, lasted a little bit longer on one metric, a little bit shorter on another metric. But China could be, Communist Party could become the most, could break those records. It could last a lot longer. But Chinese are very keen students of their own history, and they know that the longest running dynasties of the last 1,000 years didn't last for more than a couple hundred years. Those were very different times. It's extremely unlikely that the Communist Party will be able to hold on to power for that long. And as for what would happen after the Communist Party falls from power, if they begin to lose power, it's very difficult to say. My recommendation in the article is that, hey, what happened to the pre, it represents a much better afterlife for a party that had a monopoly on power than what happened to the Soviet Union.
Right. So actually, I guess more what I'm getting at is not so much the future, but right now, what are some tensions or weak points in the Communist Party? In particular, I think you mentioned the article, and I've seen it a lot in the past year or so in the news. I know there's a ongoing fascination with corruption in China. Can you talk a little about that and how it's affecting Xi Jinping and other Chinese leaders?
Yeah, so Xi Jinping, since coming to power in November 2012, I think a month after, announced a sweeping anti-corruption campaign where he'd go after both the flies, namely low-ranking corrupt officials, and the tigers, high-ranking corrupt officials. And since then, we're not sure exactly when this happened, he has started a campaign against a man named Zhou Yongkang, who was a former standing committee member of the Politburo. He was the one responsible for domestic security, probably for oil policy, for a lot of other important arenas. He stepped down in November 2012, and since then, he has almost certainly been targeted by Xi. I'm caveating that a bit because Xi has not said anything about it. No Chinese officials have admitted to a campaign against Zhou Yongkang, but the way it's being portrayed in Chinese media and all of the signs surrounding it make it extremely likely that Zhou is being targeted. And the challenge that Xi faces is cleaning house without bringing the whole house down. He needs to excise Zhou from the system while maintaining support among other high-ranking officials and maintaining support among the people who he has to communicate that this is not, or this is very little, a political power struggle, and more, hey, Zhou Yongkang and his family were extremely corrupt, and we need to remove this corruption from our party.
Now, Xi himself has not entirely escaped corruption accusations, right? I mean, Xi and probably his allies as well. Can you talk a little about that? Or
Yeah, so the exposés that the excellent exposés, I should say, that Bloomberg and the New York Times have done about Chinese leaders have been very, very careful to say that they found no evidence of wrongdoing among the leaders themselves. And it was just in ways their families might have inappropriately traded on the connections that they have by being related to these powerful people. So when Bloomberg did his piece on Xi Jinping, you know, they were very clear to say, you know, he's not being accused of any wrongdoing, but his family has made a lot of money, perhaps all of it legally under Chinese law, in connections that benefit from Xi's political connections. The most egregious example is the former premier Wen Jiabao, who the New York Times found that his family had, I think, an estimated $3 billion in assets, almost all of it facilitated by Wen Jiabao's position in power. So Zhou is far and away not the only one. My sense is that he's maybe more corrupt than average among members of the Politburo Standing Committee, but it doesn't seem like he is perceived as the worst. That said, this is a very inexact science.
Right. Now, China has a state-controlled media and a heavily censored internet, but are these stories like this Bloomberg New York Times story about Xi and Wen and other Chinese leaders and possible corruption in their families, are these stories getting out to the Chinese public or some segment of the Chinese public? And how does that happen, if so?
They are. I think these stories tend to be pretty widely circulated on the internet, on the popular microblogging platform, Sina Weibo. I think the New York Times, when they published their Wen Jiabao expose, also published it in Chinese and also released a PDF version in Chinese so that if their website was blocked, which it eventually was and is still, to my knowledge,
the entire New York Times website?
I believe the entire New York Times website is still blocked in China. I'd have to check, but last I checked, it was. So circulating a PDF version is a good way for that to move around. But I think interested Chinese, The way the firewall works is that it's porous. It just makes it more difficult to access certain pieces of information. So Chinese who know how to use a proxy server, who know how to jump over what's called the Great Firewall, can pretty easily access this information.
Mm-hmm. We should probably wrap up, but anything else you want to say about your article or about stories in China that maybe people aren't paying as much attention to as they should?
I do think the story of Zhou Yongkang is the most important thing happening in China right now. It's also one of the most difficult stories to understand in China. So it's basically Bo Xilai times 10. It's basically Zhou Yongkang's position in the former administration was similar to Dick Cheney's position in this one. So it would be similar to Obama mounting a massive campaign against Dick Cheney. And you can imagine the way that would ripple through the U.S. government, and it's probably rippling through the Chinese government the same way.
I can imagine many chaotic implications. I can also imagine many happy people that I know personally. I guess it would be hard. And Obama has always wanted to avoid the appearance of a politicized investigation of any part of the Bush administration, to the relief of them and the consternation of some of Obama's liberal supporters, I know. So, anyway, thank you so much for coming on, Isaac. This has been very informative, and we should do this again sometime. There's a lot to cover.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Talk soon.